friendly, warm look, all right, and yet it was strange. It was a sort of glistening smile with tears and joy suffusing it, both tears and joy. In fact, it was an ancient look, from the primordial past, never seen in America before. It was the smile of homage and astonishment at such bravery that had been given to single combat warriors in advance, on account, before the fact, since time was. Well, Glenn was ready. He was ready for election. He was ready to be the first to go into the heavens when the debt of homage and honor and glistening faces came due. One of the people who beamed that look at them with a sincere devotion was a Washington lawyer named Leo D'Orsay. Walter Bonney, the NASA public affairs officer who had run the press conference, had seen the frenzy of publicity building up around the seven men and concluded that they needed some expert help in their new role as celebrities. He approached D'Orsay. D'Orsay was a tax lawyer. Harry Truman had once considered making him head of the Internal Revenue Service. He had represented many show business celebrities, including President Eisenhower's friend Arthur Godfrey. So the seven of them wound up having dinner with D'Orsay in a private room at the Columbia Country Club outside of Washington. D'Orsay was an affable gentleman with a little round pot belly. He had terrific clothes. He put on a long face and related how he had been approached by Bonney. He said he was willing to represent them. "I insist on only two conditions," he said. Glenn thought to himself, "Well, here it comes." "One," said D'Orsay, "I will accept no fee. Two, I will not be reimbursed for expenses." He kept a grave look on his face for a moment, and then he smiled. There were no catches and no angles. He was obviously sincere. He thought they were terrific and felt tickled pink to be involved with them at all. He couldn't do enough for them. And that was the way it went with Leo D'Orsay from that evening onward. He couldn't have been straighter or more generous. D'Orsay proposed that the book and magazine rights to their personal stories be put up for sale to the highest bidder. Bonney was sure the president and NASA would allow it, because several military men had made such an arrangement since the Second World War, most notably Eisenhower himself. The selling point for NASA would be that if the seven of them sold exclusive rights to one organization, then they would have a natural shield against the endless requests and intrusions by the rest of the press and would be better able to concentrate on their training. Sure enough, NASA approved the idea. The White House approved it, and D'Orsay started getting in touch with magazines, setting $500,000 as the floor for bids. The one solid offer, $500,000, came from Life, and D'Orsay closed the deal. Life had an excellent precedent for the decision. Few people remembered, but the New York Times had bought the rights to Charles Lindbergh's personal story before his famous transatlantic flight in 1927. It worked out splendidly for both parties. Having bought an exclusive, the Times devoted its first five pages to Lindbergh the day after his flight, and the first 16 the day after he returned from Paris, and all other major newspapers tried their best to keep up. In return for Life's exclusive rights to their personal stories and their wives, the astronauts would share the $500,000 evenly. The sum amounted to just under $24,000 a year for each man over the 3 years Project Mercury was scheduled to run, about $70,000 in all. For junior officers with wives and children used to struggling along on $5,500 to $8,000 a year in base pay, plus another $2,000 in housing and subsistence allowances, and perhaps $1,750 in extra flight pay, the sum was barely even imaginable at first. It wasn't real. They wouldn't see any of it for months in any case. Nevertheless, the goodies were the goodies. A career military officer denied himself and his family many things, with the understanding that when the goodies came along, they would be accepted and shared. It was part of the unwritten contract. The Life deal even provided them with foolproof protection against the possibility that their personal stories might become all too personal. Although written by Life, the stories would appear in the first person under their own bylines. By Gus Grissom. By Betty Grissom. And they would have the right to eliminate any material they objected to. NASA, moreover, would have the same right. So there was nothing to keep the boys from continuing to come across as they had looked like at the first press conference. Seven patriotic, God-fearing, small-town Protestant family men with excellent backing on the home front. Here in the summer of 1959, that was fine with Life and with the rest of the press, for that matter. Americans seemed to be deriving profound satisfaction from the fact that the astronauts turned the conventional notions of glamour upside down. It was assumed, and the genteel beast kept underlining the point, that the seven astronauts were the greatest pilots and bravest men in America precisely because of the wholesome circumstances of their backgrounds. Small towns, Protestant values, strong families, the simple life. Henry Luce, Life's founder and boss of bosses, had not played a major role other than parting with the money and making the astronaut deal, but eventually he came to look upon them as his boys. Luce was a great Presbyterian, and the Mercury astronauts looked like seven incarnations of Presbyterianism. This was no rural American miracle, however. It was John Glenn who had set the moral tone of the astronaut at the first press conference. The others had diplomatically kept their mouths shut ever since. From the Luces and Restons on down, the press, that ever-seemly Victorian gent, saw the astronauts as seven slices of the same pie, and it was Mom's pie, John Glenn's Mom's pie, from the sturdy villages of the American heartland. The gent thought he was looking at seven John Glenns. Among the seven instant heroes, John Glenn's light shone brightest. Probably the least conspicuous, using that same measure, was Gordon Cooper. Cooper was a thin, apparently guileless soul, handsome in a down-home manner. He was from Shawnee, Oklahoma. He had a real Oklahoma drawl. He was also the youngest of the seven, being 32 years old. He had never flown in combat. Nor had his test work at Edwards been of the sort that attracted much notice. Scott Carpenter was no further up the ziggurat of flying, of course, but Carpenter was not at all reluctant to talk about his own relative lack of experience in jets and so on. What seemed to annoy some of the boys was that none of the foregoing, obvious as it surely was, fazed Gordon Cooper in the slightest. Two people who sometimes seemed to get impatient with Cooper were his Air Force comrades Gus Grissom and Deke Slayton. Grissom and Slayton had been great pals practically from the day they were selected as astronauts. They were from out of the same grim clay. Slayton was raised on a farm in western Wisconsin, up near the town of Sparta and the Elroy Sparta State Park Trail. He was taller than Grissom, more rugged, rather handsome, in fact, and quite intelligent once you penetrated the tundra. When the subject was flying, his expression lit up and he radiated confidence and had all the wit and charm and insights you could ask for. In other situations, however, he had Grissom's lack of patience for party manners and small talk, and Grissom's way of lapsing into impenetrable blank stares as if some grim wintertime North Country Lutheran cloud of original sin were passing in front of his face. Deke had started flying in the Second World War when the Air Force was still part of the Army. In the Army, one was continually around people who spoke Army Creole, a language in which there were about 10 nouns, 5 verbs, and 1 adjective, or participle, or whatever it was called. There always seemed to be a couple of good buddies from Valdosta, or Oilville, or someplace sitting around saying, "I told him if he tried to fuck me over, I was gonna kick his fucking ass, isn't that right? Fucking A. So he kept fucking me over and I kicked his fucking ass in for him. Isn't that right? Fucking A. And so now they're telling me they're going to throw my fucking ass in a fucking stockade. You know what? They some kind of fucking me over. Fucking A. Well told, boa." Now that Deke was all of a sudden a celebrity, there were people who knew him who cringed every time he got near a microphone. They were afraid he was going to Army Creole the nationwide TV and scorch the brains of half the people of the USA. The truth was, Deke, was far too sharp for that. He was okay in Gus's book. They lived just two doors away from each other at Langley, and if they were both at home on the weekend, they usually did something together, such as go hunting or wangle a T-33 from Langley Air Force Base and fly cross-country taking turns at the controls. Sometimes they would fly all the way to California and back, and it was likely that if they exchanged a total of 40 sentences transcontinental, they would come back feeling like they had had a hell of an animated conversation and a deep talk. Just a couple of years ago at Wright-Patterson, it was Gus and Gordo, as Gordon Cooper was known, who had been the great weekend flying buddies. Then Gordo had been transferred to Edwards, where Deke Slayton happened to be. And now that all three of them were in the same corps, this extraordinary new corps of astronauts, there were nights when the others would hear Cooper's Oklahoma drawl getting cranked up, and the gorge would rise. They would all be knocking back a few at somebody's house some Saturday night, and they would hear Cooper starting to talk about something extraordinary that happened when he was testing the F-106B or whatever at Edwards, and the blood would come into somebody's baleful eyes, and he'd say, "I tell you what Gordo did, Edwards. He was in engineering." The way engineering was pronounced, you would have thought Gordo had been a quartermaster or a drum major or a chaplain. Deke Slayton took pride in the fact that he was in the hot branch of flight test at Edwards, which was fighter operations. The pilots and fighter ops at Edwards pushed the outsides of the envelopes of the hottest new airplanes made, the most recent examples being the Century series, of which Gordo's F-106B was one. But to be in engineering was to be an also-ran. Gus and Gordo remained friends and even did some rat racing in their cars together and later on in speedboats. He was so friendly and easygoing, it was hard not to like the man. But sometimes Gus would cluck and fume over Gordo's yarns, too. None of this fazed Gordo in the slightest. He seemed to be oblivious of it all. He just went on, drawling and lollygagging along as if he were sitting in the catbird seat the whole time. He was also given to sounding off now and then in ways the rest of them just couldn't comprehend, like that business of the flight pay. The truth was that none of them, not even Gus, who knew him fairly well, understood Cooper's particular makeup. Cooper may have had his blind spots, but if so, it was the blindness of the fighter jock resolutely making his way up the mighty ziggurat. So what if, by outward standards, he had not had the most brilliant career of all the seven astronauts? Bidet was young. He was only 32. Cooper's fighter jock self-esteem seemed to be like a par lamp. It was as if, wherever he landed, the light shone round about him. That was the place to be. Cooper knew as well as anyone that it was more prestigious to be in fighter ops than in engineering at Edwards, but once he was in engineering, the light shone around about him, and the picture of him in that place was good. As a pilot in engineering, you saw the projects from both sides, from the design and administrative side, as well as from the test pilot side. It was like being a project manager who also flew. That was what it was like. Much of Cooper's fireproof confidence was based on the fact that he was a natural-born stick-and-rudder man, as the phrase went. When it came to sheer aplomb and controlling a winged aircraft, there was probably no other astronaut who could outdo him. His father had been a colonel in the old Army Air Force, a career officer, and Cooper had started flying before he was 16. He had met his wife, Trudy, at Hickam Field after he had enrolled in the University of Hawaii. She was also a pilot. Flying was like breathing to Cooper. He seemed to feel absolutely immune to the ordinary dangers of flight. In any event, he was absolutely cool when it came to dealing with them. As far as his career went, he was never troubled by doubts. It was only a matter of time before everything would go his way. Of that, he seemed to be convinced. When the tests for selection of astronauts began at Loveless and Wright-Patterson, well, it was obvious, wasn't it? Everything was now going his way. He never had the slightest doubt that he would be chosen. His relative lack of credentials didn't trouble him at all. He would be chosen. He could tell. When it came to things like the rigors of physical test at Loveless, he went through it all with a knowing wink. Things like scuttling down a corridor with barium exploding out of your tail, he figured it was intentionally set up as part of the stress testing. Nothing to it once you understood the drill. Stress? He was so relaxed, the psychologist giving the stress test at Wright-Patterson could hardly believe it. As soon as the test at Wright-Pat were completed, Cooper told his commanding officer at Edwards that he had better look for a replacement for him. He was going to be chosen as an astronaut. This was more than a month before the choices were actually made. Cooper turned out to be neither so naive nor so guileless as some thought. From the beginning, in the interview sessions, the NASA psychologist had asked the candidates for astronaut many questions about their family lives. Quite aside from any possible public relations considerations, there was a well-known theory in the psychology of flight to the effect that marital discord was a major cause of erratic behavior among pilots and often led to fatal accidents. The sound instincts of the career officer led Cooper to respond that his family life, with Trudy and the children, was real fine, terrific, regulation issue. This wasn't likely to bear much checking into, however, inasmuch as Cooper and Trudy were not living in the same house or even in the same latitude. They had separated. Trudy and the children were living down near San Diego while he remained at Edwards. Clearly, it was time for a reconciliation. Cooper took a quick trip to San Diego. He talked a whole rope, a veritable lasso. The separation, his prospects with NASA and so on. In any case, Trudy and their two daughters returned to Edwards, and Cooper had the American dream back intact under one roof before the final round of the selection process, and nobody at NASA was the wiser. After Cooper was selected, one of the life writers brought up the point that he had less experience than most of the other astronauts. Cooper was not fazed for a moment. He said he was also younger than the others and would probably be the only one of them to fly to Mars. The only side of the whole deal that appeared to shake Cooper's confidence was the PR side of it. The publicity routine, the trips here and there, where various local worthies put you at the head table and whacked you on the back and asked you to get up and just say a few words. Most of the trips were to cities where components of the Mercury system were being manufactured, such as St. Louis, where the capsule was being built at the McDonnell factory, or San Diego, where the Atlas rocket was being built at Convair. St. Louis, San Diego, Akron, Dayton, Los Angeles, somebody was always suggesting that you just say a few words. It was on such occasions that a man realized most acutely that America's seven astronauts were not by any means identical. Glenn seemed to eat this stuff up. He couldn't get enough grins or handshakes, and he had a few words filed away in every pocket. He would even come back to Langley and write cards to workers he had met on the assembly line, giving them little attaboys as if they were all in this thing together, partners in the great adventure, and he, the astronaut, would never forget his, the welding inspector's, beaming mug. The idea, much encouraged by NASA, was that the personal interest of the astronaut would infuse everyone working for the contractors with a greater concern for safety, reliability, and efficiency. Oddly enough, it seemed to work. Gus Grissom was out in San Diego in the Convair plant where they were working on the Atlas rocket, and Gus was as uneasy at this stuff as Cooper was. Asking Gus to just say a few words was like handing him a knife and asking him to open a main vein. But hundreds of workers are gathered in the main auditorium of the Convair plant to see Gus and the other six, and they're beaming at them, and the Convair brass say a few words, and then the astronauts are supposed to say a few words. And all at once, Gus realizes it's his turn to say something, and he is petrified. He opens his mouth, and out come the words, "Well, do good work." Is an ironic remark, implying, "Because it's my ass that'll be sitting on your freaking racket." But the workers started cheering like mad. They started cheering as if they had just heard the most moving and inspiring message of their lives. Do good work. After all, it's a little Gus's ass on top of our rocket. They stood there for an eternity and cheered their brains out while Gus gazed blankly upon them from the Pope's balcony. Not only that, the workers, not the management, but the workers, had a flag company make up a huge banner, and they strung it up high in the main work bay, and it said, "Do good work." All these people, with their smiles of sympathy, didn't ask for much. A few words here and there would do fine. Do good work. Nevertheless, that didn't make these public appearances any better for Cooper. He was in the same boat with Gus and Deke, who was also no Franklin D. Roosevelt when it came to public appearances. Everybody latched onto you during these trips. Congressmen and businessmen and directors and presidents of this and that. Every hotshot in town wanted to be next to the astronaut. For the first 10 or 15 minutes, it was enough for them to breathe the same air you breathed and occupy the same space as your famous body. But then they began looking at you and waiting. Waiting for what? Well, dummy, waiting for you to say a few words. They wanted something hot. If you were one of the seven greatest pilots and seven bravest men in America, then obviously you must be fascinating to listen to. Riveting. That was what you were supposed to be. A few war stories, man. And you would sit there with the clutch in, furiously trying to think of something, anything, and it would make you gloomier and gloomier. Your light no longer shone round about you. It was on such occasions that the three Air Force men, Cooper and Gus and Deke, wouldn't have minded being like Alan Shepard. Shepard was all right. He didn't go for these public appearance stints any more than they did, but Al could shift gears any time he had to. Al was a Navy Academy man, and if he had to glad hand and shoot the breeze and trade the small talk with all these congressmen and realty board chairmen and rice tillers and get up and make extemporaneous remarks when called upon, then he would do it. Wally Schirab was another Naval Academy man, and he could play it any way he wanted to also. Wally was a regular guy, a fighter jock through and through, but he also had the knack of turning on the old Academy charm around strangers. As for the other Navy guy, Carpenter, he wasn't an Academy man, but he was Mr. Charm himself all the same. He knew how to turn on the party manners. There was damn little social crap in the Air Force, and that was probably one reason why Cooper liked the blue suit. The officers and gentlemen business was kept at a minimum. At most bases, the only well-to-do locals who invited Air Force officers to parties were the automobile dealers. They just loved the way those crazy blue suit sons of bitches bought those cars and racked them up and then came back and bought some more. In the Air Force, there was a nice piece of built-in democracy. Until an officer had reached the level of lieutenant colonel, there was only one way for him to make his mark in advance, and that was by proving himself as a pilot. If he could demonstrate that he had the right stuff in the air, there was nothing short of gross character defects that could keep him from rising through the middle ranks. In the Navy Air Force, an officer also had to prove himself in the air, but at the test pilot level, the Navy began to insist on leadership qualities as well, meaning polish and the rest of it. There you had a man like Al Shepard who had come from out of what was sometimes called the service aristocracy, which was to say Al was the son of a career officer. By now, you ran into these fellows, the second generation officers all over the service. They seemed to make up half the graduates at West Point or Annapolis like Al and Wally Schirra. Al's father was a retired Army colonel. Wally Schirra's was in effect a service family. His father had been a pilot in the First World War, had then left the service, but then became a civil engineer for the Air Force after the Second World War, helping to rebuild Japanese airfields. You very seldom ran into career officers who were sons of businessmen, doctors, or lawyers. They steered their sons away from the service. They looked down on it. So what you found were the second-generation officers on the one hand, like Shepard and Schirra, and the sons of working men and farmers on the other, fellows like Gus and Deke and John Glenn, fellows like Shepard and Schirra and Carpenter might come from small towns, strictly speaking, but it was a mistake to call them small town boys, the way you could apply that term to Gus or Deke, and it showed in the way they could handle themselves in public. It wasn't long before Cooper began to miss flying the stick and rudder life in the worst kind of way. He began to miss it the way another man might have missed food. the daily business of taking a high-performance aircraft aloft and hanging it out over the edge, this was at the heart of the fighter jock's life, even though its importance was never expressed except in the term proficiency. Pilots devoutly believed that it was necessary to fly out to the edge with regularity in order to maintain proficiency or decision-making ability. On one level, it was a logical enough equivalent to an athlete's concern with staying in shape. On another, it had to do with the mysteries of the right stuff and the ineffable joys of showing the world and yourself that you had it. It was damn strange to be in flight training as America's first astronauts and yet to be doing no flying themselves except as passengers. There was no flying whatsoever on their training agenda. As the weeks went by, all seven men began to be bothered by this, but it was Cooper who voiced the complaint publicly. The early months included a heavy schedule of lectures on astronomy, rocket propulsion, flight operations, capsule systems, and the trips to the contractors and to the subcontractors and to Cape Canaveral where the rockets would be launched, to Huntsville, Alabama where Wernher von Braun and his Germans were developing booster rockets, to Johnsville, Pennsylvania, where the human centrifuge was located. There was no end to it. On all these trips, Cooper, like the others, had to travel by commercial airline. It seemed as if he spent half of every day standing around airports waiting for luggage or going through his pockets to see how much money he had. Here he was, flying half the month as a passenger. On top of everything else, he was losing flight pay. It was no laughing matter. The RSA was negotiating the life deal, but had not yet closed it. If an Air Force captain kept up his proficiency flying, he stood to receive an extra $145 a month in flight pay. And there was not a sane blue suitor alive who did not go out and get that flight pay each month unless bedridden or grounded. The extras? My God! It was impossible to explain to an outsider, but these things were built into the psyche of the career officer like first principles. Besides, your family always needed the money. Cooper, like the other six, was being paid by the military, and so he was losing a significant percentage of his income, which hadn't been much to begin with. Not only that, an officer in the military received a mere $9 a day in expenses for day trips and $12 a day for overnight trips. To stay in hotels, to eat in restaurants, it was a losing proposition. Especially when they were supposed to be some sort of celebrities. They all felt like the biggest deadbeat celebrities in America. Say you were having lunch with five or six hotshots in Akron where you went for pressure suit fittings at B.F. Goodrich. You didn't dare reach for the check. Suppose through delayed psychomotor response or some other dreadful accident they let you have it. The damn thing might be $35 and there went your family's food money for 2 weeks. And yet the flight pay itself was the least of it. It was more evidence of the curious non-pilot status of the astronaut. Cooper figured he was spending 40 hours a month on commercial airliners in order to go through all this. What he wouldn't have given to have access to a supersonic fighter plane like the F-104B. Gus and Deke were managing to catch rides on the weekends in T-33s at Langley. But the T-33 was pretty tame stuff, a subsonic trainer. The F-104B was something. You could cut loose with it. Langley Air Force Base wasn't even equipped to maintain such an aircraft, however, so Cooper was going all the way to McGee Tyson in Knoxville, where he had a buddy who could get him signed up for the occasional workout in the F-104B. With a ship like that, he could live and breathe and maintain proficiency and keep in touch with the righteous stuff. Such thoughts were once more running through his mind as he sat down to lunch one day at Langley, when a reporter for the Washington Star named William Hines joined him and said hello. Well, they talked a bit, and one thing led to another, and pretty soon Cooper was painting the entire picture. When the story appeared in the Star depicting Cooper's complaint accurately, as a complaint common to practically all the astronauts, NASA officials were dumbfounded. Overton Brooks' House Committee on Science and Astronautics was dumbfounded. Gordo's fellow deservers of perks and goodies were dumbfounded. Even though most of them agreed with him completely, they all looked a trifle petty. Here they were, seven heroes, warriors of the heavens, patriots, and they're all over the press complaining about flight pay and airplane rides. Overton Brooks sent a committee investigator to Langley to see what the hell was going on. The report he brought back was a masterpiece, a veritable model performance in the tactful handling of the grousing of his country's first single combat warriors. The astronauts, he wrote, are fully aware of their responsibilities to the project and the American public, particularly with regard to the heroic role they are beginning to assume with the young people of the country. They have imposed upon themselves strict rules of conduct and behavior, which credits them with constructive and mature evaluation of their position as cynosure of all eyes. The only thing is, they still want their goddamn pay and some hot airplanes. Like most other wives, Betty Grissom was stuck at Langley with small children to take care of. At first, she had thought she and Gus were at last going to be able to settle in for some ordinary home life, but somehow Gus was away as much as ever. Even when he had the weekends off, he would somehow wander over to Deke's house, and before she knew it, the two of them would be heading off to the base for some proficiency flying, and there went another weekend. If Gus was home for the weekend, he was apt to get in some fast flurries of fatherhood for the benefit of their two boys, Mark and Scott. This might take the form of some good gruff Gus obedience lectures about obeying their mother when he wasn't there. Or it might take the form of something like the floating dock. The development they lived in backed up on a little lake. One weekend, Gus set about building a floating dock so that the boys could use the lake as a proper swimming hole. The problem was that the older of the boys, Scott, was only 8, and Betty was afraid they were going to drown back there. She had nothing to worry about, as it turned out. The boys never took to the swimming hole. They much preferred the swimming pool across the street at the community club. It had a diving board and a concrete apron and clear water and other children to play with. The floating dock remained out back, moldering in the lake like a reminder of the kind of fatherhood that the astronaut life began imposing on all seven families. Betty was not as upset about her husband's protracted absences as a lot of other wives would have been. When they had been stationed at Williams Air Force Base, other wives had even put pressure on her not to let Gus have so many weekends off, because it was giving their husbands ideas. But few wives seemed to believe as firmly as Betty did in the unofficial military wives' compact. It was a compact not so much between husband and wife as between the two of them in the military. It was because of the compact that a military wife was likely to say, "We are reassigned to Langley." We, as if both of them were in the military. Under the terms of the unwritten compact, they were. The wife began her marriage to her husband and to the military by making certain heavy sacrifices. She knew the pay would be miserably low. They would have to move frequently and live in depressing, exhausted houses. Her husband might be gone for long stretches, especially in the event of war. And on top of that, if her husband happened to be a fighter pilot, she would have to live with the fact that any day, in peace or war, there was an astonishingly good chance that her husband might be killed. Just like that. In which case, the code added, "Please omit tears for the sake of those still living." In return for these concessions, the wife was guaranteed the following: a place in the military community's big family, a welfare state in the best sense, which would see to it that all basic needs from health care to babysitting were taken care of, and a flying squadron tended to be the most tightly knit of all military families. She was also guaranteed a permanent marriage if she wanted it, at least for as long as they were in the service. Divorce, still as of 1960, was a fatal step for a career military officer. It led to damaging efficiency reports by one's superiors, reports that could ruin chances of advancement. And she was guaranteed one thing more, something that was seldom talked about except in comical terms. Underneath, however, it was no joke. In the service, when the husband moved up, the wife moved up. If he advanced from lieutenant to captain, then she became Mrs. Captain, and now outranked all the Mrs. Lieutenants and received all the social homage the military protocol provided. And if her husband received a military honor, then she became the Honorable Mrs. Captain. All this regardless of her own social adeptness. Of course, it was well known that a gracious, well-spoken, small-talking, competent, sophisticated wife was a great asset to her husband's career, precisely because they were a team and both were in the service. And at all the teas and socials and ceremonies and obligatory parties at the COs and all the horrible officers' wives' club functions, Betty always felt at a loss, despite her good looks and intelligence. She always wondered if she was holding Gus back in his career because she couldn't be the smiling and small-talking whiz that was required. Now that Gus had been elevated to this extraordinary new rank, astronaut, Betty was not loath to receive her share per the compact. It was as if, well, precisely because she had endured and felt out of place at so many teas and other small talk tests, precisely because she had sat at home near the telephone throughout the Korean War, and God knew how many hundreds of test flights wondering if the fluttering angels would be ringing up, precisely because her houses all the time had been typical of the sacrificial lot of the junior officer's wife, precisely because her husband had been away so much, it was as if precisely because that was the way things were, she fully intended to be the Honorable Mrs. Captain Astronaut and to accept all the honors and privileges attendant thereupon. Betty thought the life deal was terrific. She didn't have to wrestle with the angels over that 1 second. They would be getting just under $25,000 a year from it, a sum almost beyond her imagining after all those glum ochre years. But that was only part of the beauty of this goody. On the day it had been announced that Gus had been chosen as an astronaut, Betty had been even more terrified than Gus. Gus had only a NASA-controlled press conference to deal with. Betty, with practically no warning, had been mobbed, overrun at their house in Dayton by the press. They came crawling in through the windows like ravenous termites, like fruit flies, taking pictures and yelling questions. She felt as if she had been engulfed in the monster small talk tea of all times, and merely the entire country would see her as an unsophisticated Hoosier grit. To her great relief, whatever answers she had come up with emerged as coherent whole sentences and not at all foolish in the newspapers the next day, and she looked splendid in the pictures. And naturally, she did not know that the press was an anachronistic colonial animal and Victorian gent who was determined to give to all important moments the proper tone. Still, she wouldn't want to have to go through that sort of thing again. And now she wouldn't. She would only have to talk to life reporters, and they turned out to be marvelous. They were polite, well-educated, well-dressed, friendly, kind, real ladies and gentlemen. They had no desire whatsoever to make her look bad. Betty and the other wives came bursting forth like great blossoms before the 10 million readers of Life in a cover story in the September 21st, 1959 issue. Their faces, smooth, round, white things with coronas of hair, were arranged on the cover like a corsage of flowers with Renee Carpenter's face in the middle, no doubt because the editors regarded her as prettiest. But who is that? Oh, that's Trudy Cooper. And who is that? Oh, that's Joe Sherrah. And who is that? Oh, that's... They hardly recognized each other. Then they saw why. Life had retouched the faces of all of them practically down to the bone. Every suggestion of a win, a hickey, an electrolysis line, a furs of mustache, a bag, a bump, a crack in the lipstick, a rouge cilia of hair, an uneven set of the lips, had disappeared in the magic of photo retouching. Their pictures all looked like the pictures girls can remember from their high school yearbooks, in which so many zits, hickeys, whiteheads, blackheads, goopheads, goobers, pips, acne trenches, boil volcanoes, candy bar, pustules, rash marks, tooth brace lumps, and other blemishes have been scraped off by the photography studio. You looked like you had just healed over from plastic surgery. The headline said, 7 Brave Women Behind the Astronauts. Whether by design or not, Life had seized upon the idea that Luce's fellow Presbyterian, John Glenn, had put forth at the first press conference. I don't think any of us could really go on with something like this if we didn't have pretty good backing at home. Pretty good backing? Perfect backing they were going to have. Seven flawless cameo-faced dolls sitting in the family room with their page boy bobs in place, ready to offer any and all aid to the brave lads. There was something crazy about it, but it was marvelous. The week before, in the September 14th, 1959 issue, Life had ushered Gus and the other fellows out onto the Pope's balcony with a cover story headline, "Ready to Make History." That left no doubt whatsoever that these were the seven bravest men and the seven greatest pilots in American history, even if it was necessary to go easy on the details. Now Life was leading Betty and the other wives out onto that balcony. Betty, for one, did not object to that at all. They had to let Life writers and photographers come into their houses and follow them around pretty much anywhere they wanted to, but that turned out to be no particular problem. Pretty soon they all realized they didn't even have to keep their guard up. The Life people were very sympathetic. The men among them obviously had a kind of male awe of Gus and the others. You could even detect a tinge of envy every now and then, because the Life reporters and the fellows were about the same age. But they were loyal. In any case, they were hamstrung since Gus and Betty and the rest of the men and their wives had the right to censor anything that was going to appear under their names. And don't think they were bashful about it either. Not for a minute. You'd hear one of the fellows on the telephone going over a manuscript with a Life writer line by line, telling him in just so many words what could stay in and what was coming out. Oh, the Life writers sometimes had their own notions of what was candid and colorful and good copy. They liked to get on such subjects as the rivalries between the boys and such colorful matters as driving and drinking, and the unspoken intra-fraternal business of fear and courage. Well, to hell with that. It was not so much that the men wanted to come out sounding like the Hardy Boys in outer space. It was just that you'd have to be an idiot to let your personal story actually get personal. Every career military officer, and especially every junior officer, knew that when it came to publicity, there was only one way to play it. With a salute stapled to your forehead. To let yourself be turned into a personality to become colorful, to be portrayed as an egotist or a rakehell, was only asking for grief, as many people, including General George Patton, had learned. Scott Carpenter was a case in point. He was open and forthright by nature, and he happened to tell one of the Life writers how his teenage years had been anything but standard-issue astronaut corps mom's pie material, especially after his grandfather had died, and he had drifted around Boulder, raising hell when he felt like it. And some of this stuff came out in Life, without NASA being sent a draft of it. And Scott caught flack for weeks on the grounds that he had put the program in a bad light. As far as the wives were concerned, their outlook was the same as that of officers' wives generally, only more so. The main thing was not to say or do anything that reflected badly upon your husband. There wasn't much to worry about with Life on this score. If Betty or any of the others did happen to say anything wrong, she could always remove it before it saw print. As time went by, the Life writers must have despaired of getting any personal stuff at all into their personal stories. Deke Slayton's wife, Marge, had been divorced, which was a matter of record, but that wasn't about to be printed in Life magazine. A once-divorced astronaut's wife was by now an unthinkable concatenation of words. When the selection process for astronaut had begun, Trudy Cooper, Gordon Cooper's wife, had been living by herself down at San Diego. The writers from Life may have known about it, and they may not have. It was a moot point. because in any event, there were not going to be any astronauts with washed-up marriages in the pages of Life magazine on the eve of the battle in the heavens with the Russians. The exclusive rights to the personal stories of the astronauts and their families that Life had purchased did not encompass any such tangled terrain as that. And it didn't have to be that personal for them to wave the wand and make it disappear. Look at what they did to John Glenn's wife, Annie. Annie was a good-looking and highly capable woman, but she also had what was referred to as a slight speech impediment, or a hesitation in her speech. The truth was, she had a terrific stutter. The classic kind. The kind in which you get hung up on a syllable until you either force it out or run out of breath. Annie was game about it, and she would hang in there until she said what she wanted to say, but it was a real disability. Everywhere except in Life magazine. In Life magazine, there were going to be no ferocious, stammering jackhammer stutters on the home front. As for Betty, she came out in Life as the thoughtful, articulate, competent, much-respected, honorable Mrs. Captain Astronaut. She didn't ask for much more than that. If it pleased them, the people at Life could sit around removing dour, grim grit, and zits until they earned a place beside the angels and retouch heaven. Chapter 7. The Cape. Cape Canaveral was in Florida, but not any part of Florida you would write home about, except on one of those old Tickner Brother postcards on which there is a drawing of two grinning dogs positioned in front of a lamppost, each with a hind leg hoisted, and a caption that says, "This is a wonderful place, just between you and me and the lamppost." No, Cape Canaveral was not Miami Beach or Palm Beach or even Key West. Cape Canaveral was Cocoa Beach. That was the resort town at the Cape. Cocoa Beach was the resort town for all the low-rent folk who couldn't afford the beach towns farther south. Cocoa Beach was so low rent that nothing on this earth could ever change it. The vacation houses at Cocoa Beach were little boxes with front porches or verandas nailed onto them and a 1952 DeSoto coupe with Venetian blinds in the rear window, rusting in the salt air out back by the septic tank. Even the beach at Cocoa Beach was low rent. It was about 300 feet wide at high tide and hard as a brick. It was so hard that the youth of post-war Florida used to go to the stock car races at Daytona Beach, and then, their brains inflamed with dreams of racing glory, they would head for Cocoa Beach and drive their cars right out on that hard-tack strand and race their gourds off, while the poor sods who were vacationing there gathered up their children in their scotch plaid picnic coolers and ran for cover. At night, some sort of prehistoric chiggers or fire ants, it was hard to say, since you could never see them, rose up from out of the sand and the palmetto grass and went for the ankles with a bite more vicious than a mink's. There was no such thing as first-class accommodations or red carpet treatment in Cocoa Beach. The red carpet, had anyone ever tried to lay one down, would have been devoured in mid-air by the no-see-em bugs, as they were called, before it ever touched the implacable hardcracker ground. And that was one reason why the boys loved it, even Glenn, who did not partake of all of its low-rent glories. The place reminded them of what they had heard Edwards or Muroc was like in the legendary days of the late 1940s and early 1950s. It was one of those bleached, sandy, bare-bone stretches where the land that any sane man wants runs out, and the government takes it over for the testing of hot and dangerous machines, and the kings of the resulting rat shack kingdom are those who test them. Just south of Cocoa Beach was Patrick Air Force Base, site for the headquarters of the Atlantic Missile Range, for the testing of the weaponry of the Cold War, guided missiles, intermediate-range ballistic missiles, and intercontinental ballistic missiles. North of Cocoa Beach, on the very tip of the Cape itself, was the huge new secret launching facility from which all these rockets and pilotless aircraft were fired, a stone boondock dune plain with the Atlantic Ocean on one side and the Banana River on the other, with soil so sandy that the scrub pines had trouble growing 15 feet high, and yet malarial and so marshy that the cottonmouth moccasins stood their ground and stared you down, the sort of hopeless stone boondock spit where the vertebrates give up and the slugs and the no-see-em bugs take over. The few buildings on the base were of the World War II beaverboard temporary variety. And like Edwards of old, the Cape, this poor godforsaken afterthought in the march of terrestrial evolution, turned out to be a paradise of flying and drinking and drinking and driving and driving and the rest, for those who cared about such things. Or of drinking and driving and the rest, in any event, there was still no flying. Langley remained the astronauts' headquarters, but the Cape would be their launching site eventually, and they went there increasingly for training. They would fly in by commercial airliner, landing in Melbourne or Orlando. Most of them would rent convertibles and head for the Holiday Inn on Route A1A just north of the old part of Cocoa Beach, a motel run by a man named Henry Landeworth, who soon found himself becoming innkeeper to the astronauts. Quite a little 1960s-style American rat shack strip was beginning to develop on Route A1A near the Holiday Inn. Hamburger restaurants with plate glass walls and hot magenta lights, night spots with contiki roofs, and little shopping slabs by the side of the highway, slabs of concrete with one-story cinder block sheds on them, broken up into storefronts with space available signs posted. Military units had always been great ones for creating traditions instantly on the spot, and this unofficial corps of astronauts was no exception. The tradition was, the Cape is off-limits to wives. This came about rather naturally. The Cape was not a good place for wives and children, because you couldn't count on finding kitchen facilities in the motels, and there were none of the usual beach resort amenities, and none of them could afford the plane fares for family trips to Florida in the first place. Besides that, the boys' training hours were very long, sometimes 10 or 12 hours a day. They did nothing at the Cape but work their butts off all day and then fall into bed, albeit this was a matter open to interpretation. The boys' training at the Cape was not so much arduous as tedious. It was sedentary, even. It involved no flying. Some days they would be briefed on launch procedures, or they would drive out to the launching base and go inside an old converted rat shack hangar, Hangar S, and sit all day in a simulator known as the Procedures Trainer, which on the inside was a replica of the capsule they would ride in during flight. Or technically they sat in there all day. In fact, they were lying down. It was as if you took a chair and pushed it over backwards, so that its back was on the floor and then sat in it. That was the position the astronaut would be in during his launch atop the rocket, and the position he would be in as he came down toward the water inside the capsule at the end of the flight. It was hard for Glenn, or anyone else, to explain exactly what you did for 10 or 12 hours inside this thing, but clearly, once a man had had a day full of this tedious regimen, he was ready to limber up a little, get the blood flowing again, wiggle his fanny a bit. For Glenn, it was enough to go out to that hardtack strand at Cocoa Beach and run 2 or 3 miles. It was the greatest long-distance running track you could possibly ask for, with pure ocean air to help your pump get going efficiently. And there would be John Glenn, the very picture of astronaut dedication, pounding along the same shore from which he would one day be hurled into the heavens. John Glenn running for the big one at Cocoa Beach was an even better picture than the one he had put on display at Langley. Glenn noticed that some of his confrères were loosening up in quite another way, however, which is to say they were checking in at the holy coordinates. After a long day of make-believe flying in the simulator, a little drinking and driving in the rest of the real pilot's life. The driving eventually took on an extraordinary dimension here at the Cape. Gus Grissom and Gordon Cooper, and then Al Shepard and Wally Schirra, would discover Jim Rathman. Rathman was a big, rugged character who had one of the largest automobile dealerships in the area, a General Motors agency about 20 miles south of Cocoa Beach near Melbourne. It was typical Air Force stuff that Gus and some of the others should become great pals of his. Rathman was no ordinary auto dealer, however. He turned out to be a racing driver, the best, in fact. In 1960, he won the Indianapolis 500 after having finished second three times. Rathman was a great friend of Ed Cole, the president of Chevrolet. Cole had helped Rathman set up his agency. When he found out that Rathman knew the Mercury astronauts, he became the astrobuff of all astrobuffs. America seemed to be full of businessmen like Cole who exercised considerable power and were strong leaders, but who had never exercised power and leadership in its primal form, manly courage in the face of physical danger. When they met someone who had it, they wanted to establish a relationship with that righteous stuff. After meeting the astronauts, Cole, who had just turned 50, was determined to learn to fly. Meantime, Rathman set up a leasing agreement whereby the boys could lease any type of Chevrolet they wanted for practically nothing per year. Eventually, Gus and Gordo had Corvettes like Al Shepard's. Wally moved up from an Austin Healey to a Maserati, and Scott Carpenter got a Shelby Cobra, a true racing vehicle. Al was continually coming by Rathman's to have his gear ratios change. Gus wanted flared fenders and magnesium wheels. The fever gripped them all, but Gus and Gordo especially. They were determined to show the champ, Rathman, and each other that they could handle these things. Gus would go out rat racing at night at the Cape, racing full bore for the next curve, dealing with the oncoming headlights by psychokinesis, spinning off the shoulders and then scrambling back up on the highway for more of it. It made you cover up your eyes and chuckle at the same time. The boys were fearless in an automobile. They were determined to hang their hides right out over the edge, and they had no idea what mediocre drivers they actually were, at least by the standards of professional racing, which is to say they were like every group of pilot trainees at every base in America who ever reached that crazed hour of the night, when it came time to prove that the right stuff works in all areas of life. Cocoa Beach had begun to take on the raw excitement of a boomtown and the manic and motley cast of characters that go with it. In boomtowns of the oil gush or gold rush variety, the excitement had always come from simple greed. But Cocoa Beach was more like a Second World War boomtown. There was enough greed in the air to make things spicy, but the true fervor was the joie de combat. People coming out to work at the Cape for NASA, private contractors, or whomever, felt like part of the mad rush to battle the Soviets for dominion over the heavens. At Edwards, or Murak, in the old days, the worthy warriors used to repair in the evening to ponchos, which, though theoretically a public place, was like a club for the adventurers over the high desert. At the Cape, by 1960, the warriors had the motels on the Rat Shack Strip along Route A1A. At night, the pool areas of the motels became like the roaring fraternity house lounge of Project Mercury. Very few people, no matter what their rank in the project, had a place big enough, much less attractive enough, to entertain in. But every night, the fraternal lounge was open, under the skies, in the salt air, out near the beach, and the party was on. And one and all braved the palmetto bugs and the no-see-em bugs and celebrated the fact that they were on the scene where this great Cold War adventure was taking place. Naturally, nothing gave the party quite so much magic as the presence of an astronaut. And Glenn could see that after 8, 10, 12 hours of lying cooped up in the procedures trainer out in Hangar S, most of his brethren were ready to provide the magic. No matter what time it was beer call time, as they said in the Air Force, and they would get in their cars and go barreling into Cocoa Beach for the endless, seamless party. And what lively cries and laughter would be rising up on all sides as the silvery moon reflected drunkenly on the chlorine blue of the motel pools. and what revelers were to be found. There were NASA people and the contractors and their people, and there were the Germans. Although they scrupulously avoided publicity, many of Wernher von Braun's team of V2 experts had important jobs at the Cape and were happy to find a fraternal atmosphere in which they could take off their official long faces and let the funny bone out for a tap dance or two. And many were the